Good evening, everybody.
Love Talk Radio.
Good evening, everybody. I am in the East Coast in New York, so good evening to all of you, and thank you for being with us tonight. My name is Jose Albino, and I will be your host this evening. As usual, in order to give people time to log in and be with us tonight, but more importantly, to set a more developmental tone for the show, I usually open up with a few of my favorite quotes. Today, I will open up with one because we have an important show for you, and I want to definitely get started as quickly as possible. And the first quote, which I actually was reading yesterday on the train, was by Theodore Roosevelt, and it reads, "It is not the critic who counts, not the man who points out the strong man that stumbles, or where the doer or deed could have done them better. The credit belongs to the man that is actually in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who errs, and if he fails, at least he fails while daring greatly." So I just wanted to share that quote with you. I found it to be very powerful. As I mentioned, my name is Jose Albino, and I'll be your host tonight. Welcome to my show, Purposeful Conversation, here on the Life Coach Radio Network, where my focus and my mission is to engage in conversations of varying topics that lift the spirits and inspire people to be their best selves. Via our conversations, my goal is also to give practical, and the guests as well, to give practical, applicable, proven, and attainable skills, knowledge, and nuggets that they can use in their own personal lives. Today, I have a show for you on a topic that is very, very near and dear to my heart, and that's caregiving. As some of you know, for those that may know me personally or those that listened to my last show, up until recently, I worked with senior citizens and their families for over 15 years on quality of life and end-of-life issues. I've seen the good, the bad, and the ugly. And today I honor and I take my hat off to my two guests, Emily and Lopez and Sandy Gomez, for being caregivers and for honoring their loved one, because me knowing their story and knowing what I know about those souls who didn't have or don't have love and understanding during their time of need, I consider them to be brave and considerate for sharing their stories of caring for their loved one and their struggles and triumphs while doing so, in hopes of helping and reaching others. And we'll definitely get to them in a minute. This show, which I'm aptly calling Daring to Care, will focus on what I consider to be extraordinary stories of hope and love and resilience in difficult times by these two ordinary people. You know what? They're extraordinary stories, and they're equally extraordinary people. Both of you, I just want to acknowledge you again and thank you for agreeing to share your personal stories with us. I also want to thank the listeners for making the decision to be with us tonight. Briefly, I just want to be clear that although the conversation will focus on caring for an elder, I recognize and acknowledge that caregiving also extends to anyone that is a caregiver to someone of any age that has a permanent or temporary or situational illness or circumstance. Having said that, I want to give you some information and data in order to put this conversation into the context regarding caregiving and caregivers. According to the National Family Caregivers Association, more than 50 million people provide care to a chronically ill, disabled, or aged family member or friend during any given year. Now, out of those 50 million, 30 million households are providing care to adults 50 years or older. Another interesting fact is that serving, as a lot of us know, serving as a caregiver can impact a person's overall health and career. And family givers experiencing extreme stress age prematurely. Studies have shown that the stressors of making a decision of caregiving can take as much as 10 years off of a caregiver's life. And lastly, and for me, importantly, and this is not a fact, but I believe to be true, and this was said by Rosalynn Carter, who was the wife of ex-President Carter, who was a caregiver herself, and I found that this resonated with me, working with seniors and working with caregivers, is that there are four kinds of people in the world. Those who were caregivers, those who are caregivers, those who will be caregivers, and those who will need a caregiver. So please listen with an open heart, because if it hasn't impacted you at some point based on these four individuals that Mrs. Carter's identified, it possibly will. Just briefly for today's show, I will not be taking any questions because we really do have a packed show for you, for the listeners, and I really want to focus on them and on our guests and their stories. So having said that, I want to move over to Emily. Emily Lopez, welcome to the show. Thank you for being here with us tonight. And if you can just tell us a little bit about your story of being a caregiver.
Okay. Thank you for having me on the show. I think this is an important topic that it's not necessarily freely discussed. And I think that this is a great beginning, at least for me, to begin to have this conversation openly and so publicly. My story began what I now realize, looking at hindsight of 2020, that my mom was impacted by Alzheimer's long before we actually really noticed. She was very independent, and it was only when we started realizing some inconsistencies that myself and my sister began to take action. And this was challenging because she didn't want any help. She made clear that she didn't want us helping her. And as a matter of fact, when it became very challenging to even provide her with any support, taking her to doctors, she would rather have had a home attendant than have us go with her. So it was really tough in those situations. But as the inconsistencies kept coming forward and we kept seeing that she was deteriorating mentally, not physically. Physically, she was fine. My mom was officially diagnosed with Alzheimer's at the age of 62. So she was very young. She looked very young. She acted very young. So no one really, when we started asking for more support in terms of home attendance, it became really challenging because they didn't want to necessarily provide the support because they saw her as being fine. And now my background is in social work. So I found myself providing the home attendants with more support and training than they were actually getting in their jobs for people with Alzheimer's and people with Alzheimer's at her age. But the turning point for caregiving came on Mother's Day 2011. When my mom got lost. She went for a walk. The home attendant was not there. She was not scheduled to be there. We were scheduled to pick her up and spend Mother's Day with her. And she left. No coat, just her keys. And it was a nice, sunny Mother's Day. And we found her 19 hours later. And mostly we found her because she had an Alzheimer's emergency bracelet that we had attached to her keys because she didn't want to wear it. And the family that she ended up in their home was in East Harlem. So she lived in the Lower East Side, and she ended up in East Harlem on 105th Street in Madison. And the family called the Alzheimer's 1-800 number, and they told them their address, and I went to get my mom. At that point, we knew we needed more help than we can actually provide her, my sister and I could provide her at that point. And it became increasingly difficult to request support because at that point they didn't want to even give us or increase any of her hours for a home attendant to be there 24 hours. So that was a start of a roller coaster ride that I can say was very challenging for myself and my sister.
Wow, that's very powerful. I mean, I hear issues of when she didn't allow you to, or want you to take her to the doctors. I mean, there's a lot of shame behind certain diseases, particularly Alzheimer's and dementia. And it sounds like she would have preferred the home attendant as opposed to, let's say, you or your sister, the family member, to accompany her to the doctor.
Yes. I mean, she's one of 13 siblings, and two of her brothers were diagnosed now almost 15 years ago with Alzheimer's. So she was a witness to watching their deterioration. So I'm sure that once she realized what was going on, she didn't want us to watch her go through it. And we understood, and I respected that. And we were able to get a home attendant. I think the biggest challenge was there was no consistency in the home attendant. I think that if we had a consistent home attendant, it would have been much better for her care.
Which is very, very common in the field of aging in terms of consistency of home attendants, difficulty of dealing with the home care agency and try to give her more hours. So I definitely understand and empathize with you on that aspect. Thank you for sharing that piece of the story. So, Sandy, why don't you tell us a little about your story of being a caregiver?
Good evening, everyone. My story started about 18 plus years ago. I was having a blossoming career in the arts when I got the call, and it was my mother telling me that I needed to come home because she needed to speak to me in person. I got home and she explained to me that the doctors found something wrong with her. They called it Parkinson's. At the time, I just knew, we always know the celebrities who have the illness. So I knew of Michael J. Fox, I knew of Muhammad Ali. So I didn't know what the whole scope of it was. But then I realized that not only was my mother impacted by this illness, but I soon would be also. I was the youngest, and my siblings had their own lives to live. It befell on me to take charge and manage my mother's affairs, deal with her illness head on, and it was a very tough moment in my life for me. It was very devastating. I was very angry. I was angry at God. I was angry at the world. I was upset that I had to postpone my dreams and ambitions and, get a 9-to-5 and try to, work the system, learn about what things I needed to do for her, go with her to her appointments, try to get her services. And it was a long haul, and it wasn't easy. I came up upon a lot of brick walls in the very beginning. Then there's also the issue with my mother, who was a very strong woman and who couldn't understand her illness. So her independent nature conflicted with her illness because she felt she could do things and she needed to do things and she wanted to be alone and she wanted to go outside and she wanted to go to the store. And I had to remind her, you have this illness and you can't trust your mobility. You can have a fall, you can have, some kind of head trauma or some kind of issue. So, and these were fights we had constantly. you know, we eventually did get a home attendant for her. It started off a couple of hours, and it wasn't even worth it because of the, you know, there were some great ones who were on top of my mother and making sure she had her walker or her wheelchair or the equipment she needed. Then there were some who just were there for to talk on the phone all day and paid them no mind. So I also had to, you know, to supervise and parent that. And it was a very difficult journey for me. It was, you know, and not to sound selfish, because I know it was extremely difficult for her as well. But looking back at it, I can say that it impacted me for the rest of my life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Interesting. Thank you for sharing it. And I see a thread, you know, with home attendants. I think that the system is set up in a way such that the home attendants, they're extended family, but we all know those who gone through this process or work in the field know that the inconsistencies, you know, the home attendants, the hours, it's just very, very convoluted, and it's a very difficult web to figure out. And that brings me into the issue of family, right? Because we're talking about both of you being caregivers. So walk me through this. So when one has a sick loved one, where there's issues of illness and mortality, it's on the table, and end-of-life issues are concerned, it is often a family issue, right? But everyone in the family copes with this differently, Sandy. So why don't you tell me about how this illness or issues of care played out within your family structure?
You know, as I mentioned before, I was the youngest and the most responsible and the one who was mostly in charge of my mother's care, because my family just, they, how do I say this tactfully, they had their own lives to live, and I had no children, I had no wife, I had, you know, I was a single man. It kind of was dumped on me to be the caregiver, to do it all, to go to doctor's appointments, to manage her care. And it not only, I mean, I want to also be fair to say that not only was it wasn't just dumped on me, but I also did it with love, because she's my mother, and my mother was my world. But a lot of the decisions about her care, about any surgeries, about any procedures, her medications, all those things were really left solely to me. Because when I reached out to siblings or to her sisters and uncles, and it was, you know, they were Dominican immigrants. They, you know, they didn't know about medical advances. They didn't know about research. They didn't, you know, they were, you know, unfortunately, ignorant about Parkinson's and the system. So it was really, at the end of the day, left solely to me, and which was tough, because you take on the possibility of getting people's wrath if you make a wrong decision. You know, no one wants to ever say do XYZ, but if I say, okay, we should give her surgery, and something were to happen during surgery, I was to blame. So it was a catch-22 with my family.
So it sounds like it wasn't a shared responsibility, and the majority of the responsibility was placed on your lap for either cultural issues or just access to knowledge. It sounds like you were the one who made responsible for her care, and there was not a shared responsibility within the family unit. That's it,
correct.
Okay?
Correct.
Okay. Thank you for sharing. Emily, do you want to add some thoughts regarding family and how that might play into decisions or caregiving?
Yeah, I mean, I think that you started to share about coping mechanisms and how people cope with things differently. And I think that, you know, with the care of my mom, it was really just myself and my sister, and there are four of us. And the male siblings just kind of disappeared. They didn't take any active role. They were only there pretty much the last week of her life, literally. And so it just became very challenging. And then, you know, me being the oldest, it's just so interesting. You have a conversation with Sandy, you being the youngest, me being the oldest, but the most responsible. Our similarities are that we were both single and no children. So they were like, you know, no children, single, okay, you know, let Emily take on. Because that was part of my aunt's conversation with me was, ay, Dios mío, you know, take care of your mom and your sister because she has three kids and you have to take on the responsibility. I'm like, okay, no, that doesn't work that way. So it just became that struggle with the extended family and the immediate family, and with no one really coming to, you know, the forefront. So, you know, the most difficult conversation I had with myself was having to, you know, whether I was going to sign the DNR papers. And no one wanted to do it, and I said, no, no problem, I'll do it. So everything about emotions and, you know, my own pain had to be on the back burner because I had to step up to the plate and I had to make these decisions. So it was and continues to be challenging because you always, even though my mom is gone, I'm always second guessing myself. Did I make the right decision? Did I do the right thing? Is it what she wanted? I don't know. I don't have the answers to it.
Right. Okay. You know, it's interesting in that, you know, there's a lot of similarities between both of you, and we're talking about caregiving, right, and providing care. And one would think or one would assume that if you have kids, you will probably do a better job at caring and making certain decisions because if you're a parent, that's what you do. Your life is clearly providing and caring for your children. So it's interesting how, you know, the decision or the non-shared responsibility is given to a particular person who may not have as much savvy as perhaps someone who has a family and a unit and knows how that may work. But in the issue of what we were talking about, you know, I read an interview today with Brené Brown, who was the author of this book called Caring Greatly, who has researched vulnerability for over a decade, and she said that faith without vulnerability equals extremism, which to me was very, very powerful because extremism alludes to the fact that one knows it all and has all the answers. For any of you, what role did vulnerability or not having the answers play out for you, if at any time, and how did you cope with it?
For me, vulnerability, I would really just call it, for me, it was pure forgiveness, if that's even a term, but I found that that provides me with, you know, the comfort because myself and my mom didn't have a good relationship. I had to find love and forgiveness to everything in my past with her so that I can be present and vulnerable for her. And that was really my role. I mean, had I not found forgiveness, I would not have been present for her, and I would have been a very, very resentful and angry caretaker.
So the past relationship with your mom, it sounds like the fact that you were put in a position to be a caregiver was somewhat of a gift for you in terms of forgiving and building a new type of relationship with her?
It was. It really created a bond that I can't, you know, that really is the gift. That was the bond that I created with her and that we created together. And that love and vulnerability created even a wonderful relationship that, you know, I ended up getting married a year after, you know, that when she got lost, I ended up connecting to a wonderful partner that provided me with that continued support for my mom. So those connections that I made, that forgiveness that I made, that made it much more of a loving relationship for me and her, and made me more able to care for her the way I needed to.
Great. Sounds like it was a blessing for you. Sounds like it was a great blessing for you. So, Sandy, is it vulnerability or the feeling of being vulnerable within the context of caregiving, did that play out for you at any point?
It did much later. I unfortunately developed really bad coping mechanisms. Because I was so bitter about the turn of events in my life and, for the lack of a better word, being saddled with this burden, I really, the only way I could deal with my situation was through escapism. You know, I started drinking. I started drugging. I started having extreme promiscuous behavior. I needed these moments to escape because I didn't, otherwise I wouldn't have been the kind, loving, caregiving son that my mother needed me to be. And because I refused to be vulnerable, you know, my friends will tell you, I'm the counselor for my friends. People will see me in the streets and strangers will just start talking to me. I just have that counseling spirit. But I was never one to be vulnerable and you know, dump my stuff on folks. So I took this path of escapism with all these vices until I reached this point where I just, like a light bulb went off, and I said, I've got to stop this. I'm not going to be good for her. I'm not going to be good for myself. I'm just going down this path of this self-destruction. And I started to reach out to my friends. And when I let go of that shell and started showing vulnerability, I realized who my real friends were. Because that's when you really see who's there for you. You know, who you know, when you get those calls from the emergency room and you're like frustrated and exhausted, those friends that came through and brought me a coffee, who hung out with me in the emergency room while the doctors attended to her, that helped me tremendously. And had I known that I could be vulnerable and I could open up to people and not be shunned or not be, talked ill of, I think I would have done things differently from the beginning.
That's powerful. Thank you for sharing, and thank you for being so candid regarding this. And that's actually a good segue to my next question, you know, because, you know, we talk about vulnerability. You know, when you're a caregiver, it also enveloped in a lot of sacrifice. And one of the biggest concerns that I've worked with or research has shown, and with my experience in working with families and caregivers, is really self-care, right? Because we're so busy, or caregivers rather are so busy taking care of their loved one that the issue of self-care just gets pushed to the side. So, Emily, I want to hear a little bit from you. How did you honor yourself and take care of you during your caregiving process?
Yeah, for me, it was really challenging in the beginning because everybody was very free with my time. Everybody was trying to schedule me with what I had to do around my mom's care. And so, you know, you have the time. Go ahead, go see her. Why don't you see her 3 or 4 times? Or why don't you go and do this? And I had to set boundaries and limits to what other folks were trying to control. And in that, I realized that in order for me to be present for her, I did have to take care of myself because, you know, as she was, you know, dealing with this Alzheimer's, I'm also thinking, am I going to be impacted by this as well? So, you know, I did a lot of journaling and I still do and I've done it for years and that's been my safe haven. I run, you know, and that was clear that I needed to continue to do that. As soon as my mom got diagnosed, I can tell you that I have been changing my eating, but it was never as purposeful as when she was, you know, starting to decline, that I started to see what the impact of healthy eating was. And I had to, as Sandy, you talked about who was there and who wasn't there in terms of my friends. I looked at those relationships that were no longer healthy, that were toxic in my life, and that I had to let go, including family members. And that kept me sane, because if I had not done that, I would continue to, you know, run the course of an unhealthy environment for myself, and again, not allowing myself to be present for my mom. So it was, and it had to be consistent. Some days were better than others, because there were days that, you know, I had to be, they would call me and there was some sort of an emergency. And at that day, then I had to, okay, fine. That was not the day for me to work out or run or do journaling, but I would have to find another time. And I needed to make sure to continue to tell myself that I was that important, that I needed to continue to do that.
Wow. It sounds like you were really in this path of taking care of yourself, but this situation with your mom kind of pushed a little bit over the limit and really being more intentional about self-care issues with yourself.
Absolutely. I mean, it did. There was always self-care. You know, I'm a social worker, and you know, it's important for me to be as consistent as possible, to practice what I preach. But there are days that you let go more than others. But as my mom continued to decline, I just became much more intentional. It just became much more of a purpose in my life. And I just had to keep doing it. I had to keep doing it for my own survival and my own livelihood. Yeah.
Great. Thank you for that. Sandy, what about on your end? You know, what were some things that you did for yourself to make sure that you were your best self given the circumstances during your caregiving responsibilities?
I wanted to tag on to what she mentioned earlier, which is, in America, when a person gets ill, you don't immediately get your services overnight. And that was a big issue for me. Once my mother got the social services put together and things worked out and I was able to get freer time and able to do me, I started taking care of myself. I started, again, you know, I went to therapy. I had to start finding a more positive output for this negative energy, this stress. You know, I started going to the gym. I started eating right. I got rid of a lot of negative relationships that were feeding my negative behavior. I started also, you know, once her services were set and she had 24-hour care, and I could go away for a weekend without a fear, I started taking weekends away with my good friends, you know, to a bed and breakfast, a nice little road trip, just a space for me to go collect my thoughts, have some me time and decompress, you know, and that took a while too, because as a caregiver, I know for me, one of the biggest issues was when that phone would ring. Whenever my cell phone rang, I would immediately stress out. I would immediately get all jittery because I didn't know if it was friend or if it was foe, as in a doctor calling, a health, you know, someone else calling about another issue. So I just started, you know, taking care of myself and loving myself and you know, trying to be there for Sandy first and foremost, because it would do nobody any good if I had a heart attack tomorrow, you know. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Mm. Thank you. Thank you for sharing. I want to switch gears a little bit, and it's something that, I know for my particular culture, it's definitely a very sensitive topic, but I want to switch gears, and I want to talk a little bit about the issue of institutionalization or placing your parents in a nursing home, which a lot of caregivers do and a lot of caregivers decide not to do. And it's a very, very personal family decision to decide, right? Do I institutionalize my parent, my loved one, my husband, whoever the person may be? But respectfully, you both took different approaches to this, and there is no right or wrong decision. Emmy, talk to me a little bit about the decision that you and your family made placing your mom under the care of a nursing home.
Well, it was not an easy one, but it happened right after that Mother's Day when my mom got lost. And at that point, the state gets involved, right? So it's like child abuse. And if a child gets lost, the government gets involved. And so in the hospital, they would not allow her release unless we can actually show 24-hour care. Mm-hmm. At that point, I was working full-time, and my sister was working full-time with and had her three kids, and it was not a decision I could make to leave my job. I didn't have anybody to pay my rent, and I couldn't move in with her. So the only other way was, and they wouldn't approve 24-hour care in her home. Mm. At that point, that there was a state decision that on April so-and-so of that year that they would no longer approve 24-hour care for anyone at home because the system, according to them, had been so abused that even if my mom was handicapped, it would have to be in a nursing home. So at that point, we had a little bit of time. My uncle stayed with her in the evenings while the home attendant stayed in the day. But at that point, my uncle was also elderly, and he couldn't care for her. It was too difficult. So I found a senior home near my home. We had gone previously, even before my mom got really ill, to start looking at homes. Because we knew this was going to be the road that we're going to have to take. The first senior home was a complete disaster. And they actually, because of problems that they had with my sister, they decided to, on the day of one of the hurricanes that we had here in New York, decided to exit her out of their program without giving us any notice. So they called us that morning, and they told us, your mother is in another home, and here's the name, and here's the address. So we ended up that morning finding her in this home. She was crying. It breaks my heart. And anyway, she was there for the year, and it was really, really, really difficult.
So, I can imagine.
Anyway, here's the challenge. The challenge is that they treat our seniors like second-class citizens. They could care less. And if I am still angry about anything, it's about the institution. But at the point that we had no other choice to put her in a senior home. But I can tell you that there are other Latino families who are going through it, and were able to talk me through it so that I can ask the proper questions. Because, mm-hmm. again, although I'm a social worker, I am a social worker for youth. I mm-hmm. do not work with seniors. So the language is very different. So I had to relearn a lot of the conversation.
Well, you know, Emily, I thank you for that. And I know we've had conversations on the side about the institutions and how things work and the services, and it is an extremely difficult web to unweave. And, you know, for those of you that are listening, and I've worked with teenagers for 15 years, and I know the laws here in New York State, and I know that we're talking about caregiving and stress and you know, taking care of yourself, but it can be done. And I think that a lot of people, when you're in this situation, no one decides and wakes up, I'm going to be a caregiver today. Something that happens. That's something you plan for.
Right.
But for those of you that are listening, and that's why I think this show is so important, you must, and please listen to me, you have to fight, okay? There is absolutely no reason why your mom should have been transferred from one place to another without authority, without informing you. Absolutely no reason. I fought for seniors who have Alzheimer's and, you know, only get 4 hours and 10 hours, and I really fought. What I'm trying to say that it is an uphill battle, but some decisions are being made for you, and I know the resources are very limited, but it can be done. This 24-hour care is a sham, okay, because it costs less for our government to have 24-hour care than it would cost to keeping a senior nursing home, and that's a fact. And at the end, I'll definitely share my email. If any of you, you know, have any questions regarding that or may need some resources regarding that particular situation, because when it has to do with Alzheimer's, as you mentioned, it's very sensitive, right, because they can get lost, right? It's different than having a physical situation, right, someone that may be bedbound or wheelchair-bound or possibly blind. It's more sensitive, and you alluded to you. And how, you know, if a child were to be roaming the street, then the government clearly will get involved. But I just wanted to say that piece, and if anyone wants to reach out to me and resources, and later on Emily as well, we're going to give some information on how to reach her, please, we encourage you to do so. I'm sorry, I just needed to say that, because it does get me angry at how our laws are written, particularly for our seniors. So, Sandy, what was your position of you know, institutionalization and nursing home within your family?
Well, as I mentioned to you earlier, the decisions were always mine, but the family would always chime in. And, you know, where Emma and I differ, you know, her mom had Alzheimer's, where my mother had Parkinson's. So the risk of her getting lost like that was minimal to none, because she eventually became bedbound, so she was stuck at home. And you know, the biggest issue was, whenever I brought it up, her sisters, my brother, that's when everyone would chime in and go, Dominicans, we Latinos, we don't institutionalize our parents, we don't put our seniors in homes. And I'm like, okay, but yet no one wants to help me out. So that was a hard thing. And also, personally, I don't think I could have done it. But the, you know, one of the good things was that, if there is a good thing in this whole situation, was that my mother fell ill and had her situation prior to the Cuomo government. And the second son, and so the laws were different. She was able to get her 24-hour care. She was able to get all her services, and you know, and there were times whenever they took her to the emergency room, every doctor would tell me, she's had it for 15 years, she's had it for 16 years, you know, she really should go into a home. And, you know, we were adamant, no, she's got 24-hour care. Let them continue feeding her. Let them continue taking care of her at home. She's fine. You know, as Emmy mentioned, it's very different now. Now they don't give out 24-hour care. Now they want to put everyone and anyone in a nursing home. They just want to up and do it, you know. And I say to – I have friends who are going through that, and I say to anyone – who now has to go through that, is interact with the nursing home. Know every nurse, know every physician, know everyone, know the manager, know the director. Get in there and be seen constantly. One of the biggest issues with nursing homes is elder abuse, and that stems from elderly parents and elderly just being dumped and no one ever goes to see them. You know, you got to be there, you got to be involved, and, you know, and be seen, because then that makes them think twice before they do anything to your loved ones, you know. I know this for a fact, because I used to throw my weight around with a lot of doctors and a lot of, you know, physicians and nurses and stuff like that. So you just got to really be determined to get the best results for your loved ones. Unfortunately, you know, the resources now have changed, and nursing right. homes are now the way the way to go.
Right. Well, it sounds like for you, like I mentioned, you know, with Emily's case with Alzheimer's, it's a little different. You know, diseases or illnesses, rather, you know, have different ways in which our government prioritizes or doesn't prioritize. But it sounds like for you, your personal situation got grandfathered into this really non-existent law. I want to be very clear that there is no law on home care hours. I will tell you what does exist, and I'm going to move on a little bit because this is what gets me angry. They do give out 24-hour care. They still do it. I've been planned part of it, and I've seen it with my own eyes, and I facilitate it. It is not very easy, and it has to do with reimbursement rates. And just briefly, so you can understand what I'm talking about, now an individual has to get a managed care plan where they have Medicaid and Medicare, and I'm going to simplify it. Now, what's happening is that the government gives an HMO, I'm not going to mention any names, but we all know, well, actually, it's not within a negative context, whether it be Health First or WellCare or Fidelis, they give them a certain amount of money per month. So let's say they say, we're going to give you $10,000 for this person. Now, the HMO is not going to say, well, we're going to give you 24-hour care for your parent, because that's going to eat up our $10,000, right? Mm-hmm. That's going to eat up our $10,000. So we're going to give you less hours because we want the most money for us because we're a business. And the best route is to put them in a nursing home, because now the government pays the nursing home directly. Now we don't lose any money. So that's just a little within the context of what's really going on regarding, you know, the system. But I wanted to also talk a little bit about the issue of, you know, how I know that both of you, unfortunately, or your parents no longer here with us. What type of things do you do currently to honor them and to honor their memory?
For myself, I have created a page on Facebook. It's called Taking Care of the Caretaker. And what I am doing is I offer information. I put a lot of wonderful quotes like you did in the beginning. I also give information on healthy eating. I'll also talk about journaling. It's a little bit of everything in there just to honor the caretaker, whether it is regarding the challenges of Alzheimer's or any other dis-ease that our families or loved ones are impacted with. So that's how I honor her. And, you know, she is an amazing gift because she continues to give of her love and her spirit and her energy. And her quote was always to me, todo se puede con cuidado. Everything can happen just with care. And that will always stay with me.
Beautiful. Beautiful. Thank you. Andy, what are your thoughts?
It's still fresh one because she passed. The good Lord took her home in September. But what I do currently is I've been reaching out and being the source of knowledge and the support system for a lot of my friends who are going through it now. You know, I have several friends who are are caregivers now, and they don't know about the system. They don't know about living wills. They don't know about power of attorneys and DNRs. So, you know, I'm doing what I wish someone would have done for me when I first went down this road. So I'm assisting in that light. And also I'm now thinking about putting a lot of my experiences in essay form and, and I'm also thinking about what, like writing an essay about what to do after the person you care for is gone, because you spent all this energy and all this life taking care of someone. Now that they're gone, it's like, okay, what do you do? You know, and I don't think that's an issue that's addressed enough, you know.
I'd like to add in and say that, yeah, I mean, what happens afterwards, right? So you have all this time. You're trying to squeeze in time for yourself. And my mom will be a year that she has passed in 2 weeks. So it's like you have all this time. You don't know what to do with it, and it almost feels guilty for you to have all this time. So I spent a lot of time at home because I just didn't want to do anything. I took myself off of everything. I didn't talk to anybody because I just felt like I had to just be numb for a little bit. And any fun time just wasn't right. It didn't feel right.
Yeah. That's funny you say that, because that was my issue too. For a brief period, I needed solitude. I needed quiet. I needed peace. I needed to be alone with my thoughts, and the phone didn't ring. It wasn't the hospital. I just needed to center myself. And that's funny you say that, because, yeah, I went through the same thing.
You know, I know that some folks that are listening and perhaps still experiencing caring for a loved one, and we've talked a lot about a plethora of emotions, both in different spectrums. What would you say, each of you, please respond, what would you say was the gift, the beauty that you received by caring for your loved one?
For me, you know, I have in my journal the first time my mom ever gave me a hug. I was 34. And I put it in my journal so that I could always remember it. And I can tell you that it was, you know, through this Alzheimer's that allowed her to release some of whatever it was that was holding her captive around offering her emotions to her children. But every time I walked into her home, you know, I never saw my mom without makeup. And here I was doing her hair. You know, I dyed her hair. I never did that. And I've never done that to myself. But I dyed her hair. I would do her nails. I would just spend just wonderful quality time. Myself and my partner, we would go to the park, and we would just put on, because she was the ultimate salsera of salseras, okay? So we had to go, and we had to blast Hector Lavoe in the park, and we would always dance. And that would bring up her spirit. And it would bring up our spirit. So it was always that sort of energy and that love that really brought it back to who she really genuinely was. All that other stuff prior to her not hugging me or kissing me or telling me she loved me was just, I don't know what kept her captive. But the Alzheimer's allowed her to just be. There were no inhibitions. No, nothing. She was just her true self. And that was really the gift. But, you know, I also want to add that, you know, Sandy, you're right. It's being in the nursing home all the time, because there was never a time when the nursing home didn't know that we were going to be there. And we did pop-up visits. And we would just sit there with her for hours or just take her out whenever we wanted to. But those times really created special moments for me and for her, that I will forever keep in my heart.
Wow.
That's very beautiful, Emily. Very, very beautiful. I mean, it sounds like as you know, left of center as it may sound, it sounds like this opportunity really created the opportunity for you to have a mother-daughter relationship. It sounds in ways that you've always wanted to have.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the only thing would be I would have wanted that a little longer, you know, and that's my selfish piece. You know, I wanted her around a little longer. I wanted her, you know, we were still, my fear was always that she would forget my name. She always remembered my name. You know, she would call out and forget folks, but she knew my name. And right. those small things that we take for granted really became the most important in the end.
Wonderful. Sandy, what about you? What do you think was the best gift or the beauty within the
It's very similar to Emily's story. My mother was a very stoic, very serious Leo woman and very proud. And she was never affectionate. And she loved us, but she wasn't an affectionate mommy, kissy, huggy type of woman. And I'll never forget with her illness that there was one day where I would always, you know, brush her hair, play with her, and she would leave me alone. And then this one day, I said to her, "Mommy, I love you." And she said, "Me too." And that was our joke. After that day, whenever I would tell her, "I love you," she'd say, "Me too." And it was something so small, but that affection, seeing this sensitivity, this vulnerability of this woman that I've wanted to get to feel her love for so many years and finally get it, it was phenomenal for me. And I was able to, when the good Lord called her home, I was resigned to the fact that I was content. I had peace. You know, I didn't have what I thought others would have who didn't partake in her journey, you know, that remorse or that angst. No, when my mother was called home, I was fine. I you know, it hurt, and I will miss her dearly, but I have no regrets because I was there through it all, and it was pure love. Hello? Hello?
Yeah.
Jose?
Hello?
Yes. Hello?
I'm sorry. Failure. Brent, hello. Lord, are they going to get a call tonight? I'm sorry, I just fell off for a little while, but I caught the tail end in terms of the love, and you know, it was a moment where, you know, you would tell her that you loved her, and her little accent, she would tell you "me too," and how those simple things brought you joy.
Yeah.
Right.
And serenity at the end of her journey. I you know, I didn't have remorse or regrets. You know, and
right.
that was very important to me.
Right. You know, we've talked about caregiving, you know, in the context of, you know, what gifts, in the context of beauty, in the context of frustration, in the context of guilt. But, you know, it's interesting in the culmination of your story, in the culmination of this hour, you know, what I'm hearing is that, you know, even in the hardest times, in the deepest times, there is beauty. And it sounds like, although both of you went through this process of caregiving, that it sounds like at the end, you know, it's the gift of connecting in a way that you otherwise would probably not be able to connect with your loved one. It occurred despite their illness.
Huh.
So,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I wanted to you know, give Emily the opportunity to reference her page on Facebook before we say some last words.
Yes, it's called Taking Care of the Caretaker, and caretaker, one word. It's, if you're not that specific, it doesn't show up. And, you know, if any of the listeners have any questions or comments, you know, it's, we're about 66 people strong,
yeah.
And looking for, you know, that dialogue, and to also eliminate some of that shame around not having any secrets when our families get ill. And we think that we have to do it all on our own. And I'm hoping that at some point down the line, that would be the conversation that we could have. You know, and if, and also to start those conversations early. You don't have to wait for your families to be ill to have conversations about home care, about DNRs, and about, you know, burials. We just wait until the end, and we should be talking about that because that's part of our lives. So those are the conversations I want to continue, and I want to start on that page. It hasn't gotten there yet, but I'm hoping that, you know, as we move forward, that it will.
I'm sure that it will. I'm sure that the universe will work with you. I'm sure that it will happen. Thank you, Emily. Sandy, any last words that you want to say?
You know, I know there are people out there who feel hopeless, who feel angry, who feel a jumble of emotions about their situation, and I'm just here to say that you're not alone. You know, it gets better, and whatever you have to do positively to get some help, do it. With it's therapy, talking to a friend. You know, please, if you're out there and you want to contact me, you can do so by reaching out to Jose Albino, and he'll put me in touch with you so we can talk. But definitely, you know, take care of yourself first and foremost, because without you, there is no caregiving.
Great fast words. Listen, guys and gal, both of you, really, from the bottom of my heart, I want to thank you both again for your candor, your brevity, and for sharing your story. I know it wasn't easy, but I'm honored, and I'm sure the listeners are honored to have listened to your story. So I am humbled by your strength, and I wish you continued success in this journey, right? Because it sounds like this is still a journey. It doesn't end. The caregiving process may have ended, but it sounds like the love is still there. So thank you for being with me and the listeners tonight. I want to thank you, the listeners, for listening in, and hopefully you receive some sort of inspiration. I'm confident that you receive some inspiration and some words of wisdom from the two guests. So thank you all for listening, and hopefully you will be with me for my next show, which is another 2 weeks from tonight. If you need to reach Emily, she already referenced how to best reach her. If you need to reach me, you can reach me at josealbinocoaches@me.com. And also, if you need to reach Sandy, you can send me an email, and I'll definitely get that information to him. So thank you both. Thank you, listeners, and have a good night.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good night. God bless.
Good night. Bye-bye.